Funding for the Think Podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu. Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there any relationship between firearms and freedom? Gun rights advocates argue that good guys with guns, ready to use them responsibly to protect themselves or other innocent people, are both a deterrent and an antidote to bad guys with guns. Those who favor strict gun control worry that readily available weapons are more likely to lead to tragedy than triumph, even when their owners' intentions in buying them were good. My guest goes a step further, arguing that some of the most treasured elements of American democracy, including the rights to free speech and free assembly, are actually harder to guarantee as greater numbers of us go about our business openly or potentially carrying deadly weapons. Furman DeBrabender, is associate professor of philosophy at Maryland Institute College of Art. His new book is called Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. Furman, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You argue that gun culture is a poor fit for a 21st century democracy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that the gun culture, so far as it has developed into, in terms of open carry laws, stand your ground, and the profusion of guns, or their emergence, I should say, in public spaces, these are antithetical to the freedoms that we treasure in a democracy. And ultimately, I argue that when the Second Amendment is spun out to a certain extent, it undermines and contradicts the First Amendment.
Have guns always been an integral part of the American cultural identity?
I think so, but I think it's taken different forms throughout history. We are in a current state in history where the NRA's arguments are very strong. In that case, they're making the case for that gun rights is an individual right and increasingly an absolute right, absent regulation. For the majority of the 20th century, for example, the Supreme Court did not accept that argument, and it was only in 2008 that it was finally prevailed upon them in a split decision that the right to bear arms is indeed an individual right. But the courts have also largely accepted, and I believe that the voting public has acquiesced as the NRA makes its case that gun rights should also be absolute and unregulated.
The Pew Research Center estimated a couple of years ago that there were between 270 million and 310 million guns in America. Assuming that's accurate, that's close to one firearm for every man, woman, and child. What's fascinating about this is that while the percentage of us who own guns has fallen, the number of weapons has climbed.
Yes. That means that, and it was widely reported, of course, with each of President Obama's electoral victories in the last few years, that the gun sales surged. What this says is that while fewer households have a gun, the households that do have a gun have pretty impressive arsenals.
Who are those gun owners?
Well, author, journalist Dan Baum talks about a gun guy demographic. He describes the bulk of the gun guy demographic being white, middle-aged, middle-class, rural, suburban males. That is the bulk of the gun guy demographic.
You state at the outset that although you don't own a gun, you're not averse to others doing so as long as, not categorically averse, as long as gun ownership is wisely regulated. Some gun rights advocates argue that people who don't know guns have no business weighing in on what kind of regulation is appropriate. So how do you respond to that?
Well, what I say in my book is that that is a specious argument because I have to live with the fruit of this armed society. I have to live with the results of all these guns out there, so I am very well justified in weighing in on this.
There are people who keep guns primarily for sport. There are people who keep them primarily for self-defense, and there are probably a lot of people who fall somewhere in between. But I wonder if those two sort of poles of gun owners have really different interests in terms of regulation.
Well, nominally you would think they would, but it seems that in my research that a lot of, So I saw one, I think the same Pew Research study that you mentioned said that, you know, most recently, the most common reason that gun owners cite that they have a gun is for self-protection. In 1999, when they asked the same question, most people said for hunting. I would argue that I think a lot of, you know, hunters have also been persuaded by the NRA's political arguments, which is what I make the focus of my book. The main ingredient in their stunning success in the last 15 years. They have a saying that they like to repeat, that gun rights advocates like to repeat over and over again, which is that the Second Amendment was not written to protect hunters' rights to shoot at deer. It was written to protect people's rights to shoot at tyrants and to shoot at them effectively. And I believe that more and more people have become sympathetic to that view and that they tend to indeed equate guns with freedom.
One reason people might own guns for protection is this sense that the police can't or won't protect them from grave harm. Where does that concern come from, and is it reasonable in a country that lately has found numerous examples of individual police officers, at least, we don't want to paint them all with the same brush, but individual officers who appear to be working against citizens rather than for them?
Well, I would say a couple things to that. First of all, crime rates have been declining, and they've been declining remarkably since the early 1990s. The great bulk of that decline, it looks like it happened in the 1990s themselves. I think just about 9%, just about the early 1990s when the crime rates started to fall, they started to plummet. So we are enjoying, a great reduction in crime, and yet the American public feels differently. Gallup polls indicate that majority of Americans feel crime is getting worse when that is, in fact, not the case. As for police violence, there's a lot of discussion lately about this Washington Post article that there have been 400 police killings in this year. This is a recent article of theirs. And I don't have the date handy, but it's in the last week. But those killings, the Washington Post article indicates that something like 80% of them involve lethal weapons, in most cases guns. So how much of this police violence or this is due to the preponderance of guns out there. Police have to feel that just about everyone they pull over, even for the most trivial of offense, is armed. And they have to act accordingly. And I think that at least explains some of the police violence that we see.
Fear can be a really disturbing emotion, and there is something to be said for simply doing things that keep one from feeling afraid. But I'm curious as to whether people who own firearms report being less afraid than people who don't.
I don't have any evidence on that. They would swear up and down that they don't. They will swear up and down that they are the ones who are uniquely prepared. That's the way Wayne LaPierre puts it. There's a lot to fear out there, he wants to tell us over and over again. And he's happy to list all the things we should fear and that we should live in fear of. But when we have a gun, then we can at least feel some modicum of safety in this world that's falling apart around us. But I do think that fear plays a big role in this gun culture. I mentioned a minute ago that even though crime rates are falling, Americans feel like, crime is going the other direction. And in my book, I talk about cases in the media and examples in the media and in the news media and entertainment media alike that, I think are responsible for stoking these irrational and extreme levels of fear.
That was a really interesting chapter, and let's take the news portion first. It's a reality that if you are particularly on television running a newsroom, stories about bloody violence tend to get people's attention to a greater extent than, right. Another report about water policy.
Right.
And then in the entertainment media, shows like CSI and, law shows and crime shows, even if the good guys win out in the end, we do have the sense watching these nightly that there is always somebody lurking waiting to hurt an innocent person.
Absolutely. I mean, as far as entertainment media goes, I talk about in the book how, you know, once upon a time, it wasn't that long ago, we used to have legal dramas and we used to have hospital dramas. And I think Grey's Anatomy is the last of that tradition. Now it is dominated by police and serial killer dramas. The NCIS franchise, CSI. There are 6 spinoffs of NBC's Law and Order. You know, every hour, a different gruesome murder to consider and to worry about. But, of course, the nightly news has to compete with that, right? They have to compete with that kind of gore in order to ensure they have viewers for the 11:30 news. And so they're happy to interject with, you know, captions of the latest frenzy or catastrophe that we should worry about, whether it be it Ebola or be it, you know, schoolyard bullying that your kids should be afraid of, a latest epidemic, and of course a body found dead on a street corner. And if I may, I would just like to read very briefly. I was watching TV one night with my wife, and before the 11:30 news was coming on, and one Baltimore station, they showed the following, which was an extremely perfect case in point. In an egregious case, a Baltimore station promoting coverage of an incident in which a 14-year-old girl and her boyfriend conspired to murder the girl's father, ominously asked, and this was during the clip, "Why do some kids kill?" Followed by another clip of an expert stating earnestly, "They will strike at their most at your most vulnerable moment." Right, propagating the image that kids are contemplating killing.
Like this is a trend. Like you have to watch out
right.
Inside your own home in addition to
you
watching
You better
out
be
on
armed
the
in the living room
Goodness.
For fear of what's going on in the basement.
What do you say that to people who live in places like your hometown in Baltimore where, you know, I'm sure it varies neighborhood by neighborhood, but as you report in the book, a couple of years ago, the city was recording a murder just about every day. Is there a value in a place like that to well-intentioned people keeping firearms for self-defense?
I'm sure there is. And yet, what I would say is most remarkable is that, you know, so many people in Baltimore City don't want to have a gun for self-protection. The college I teach sits on North Avenue, and it is just a few blocks down from the recent turmoil we had in Baltimore. I mean, so we are really ground zero. Speaking with colleagues who actually live in a neighborhood right next to that, you know, just over the weekend, we were talking about guns, and they all said, "Well, they didn't feel the need to have a gun for self-protection." In that case, I think there is a feeling that walking the streets of Baltimore, where there is an active crime, there's a lot of crime, and there's an active drug culture. The feeling is that whipping out a gun in the case of an incident or a suspicious incident is only going to escalate matters and make things worse. So, for example, students in our college, when they arrive and they are given training, orientation about how to handle potential criminal incidences, they are told to take out their wallet, throw it on the sidewalk, and run away. Defuse the situation. Don't escalate the situation.
And, of course, there's the question of the ability to have weapons on campus, which Texas is now going to allow as of 2016, joining 7 other states. This is a real concern for you.
Yes, I think it is. I think it's a very bad idea. Most critics who spoke out about it have spoke out about it for the very practical concerns, right? One of the most common, there's some various analyses of the crime data on college campuses. I'm looking at an article right now that's pointing out that theft is the most common crime, the most common burglary, the most common reported crime on college campuses. That's a very bad ingredient when you have guns on campus, even if these are responsible gun owners.
My guest is Furman de Brabander. He is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art. His new book is called Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Furman de Brabander, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Maryland Institute College of Art and author of the new book, Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Joey in Denton writes, back in April, the UT system's Chancellor William McRaven spoke out against campus carry with appropriate concerns for the safety of all students. Being a retired four-star Navy admiral, McRaven champions the Second Amendment like most in Texas, yet no one for campus carry seems to listen to a man of such high credentials. Can nothing sway the pro-carry side when they dig their heels in?
I guess not. I think they're pretty. They have a pretty uncompromising view, if you will. I was reading up on the recent decision in Texas, and apparently the campus carry movement in Texas is declaring a loss because they don't deem that what the Texas legislature has done far-reaching enough. For example, it leaves private colleges exempt from campus carry, and public universities can still they still have leeway to determine how and where people can carry guns on campus and store them. And I find this all a little bit mystifying because many gun rights advocates and I suppose campus care people will consider themselves conservative, but it is a conservative virtue that there should be local control. And if this is something that the public university, the leadership in the public universities is saying, then I think we would be very wise to listen to them. The same thing happened in Florida earlier in this year. The Florida legislature ignored the will of the leadership in that university system and went ahead and passed it anyway.
We have a couple of tweets here from Stephen, who writes, sorry, I don't fit the mold of the middle-aged beer-chugging ignoramus your guest wants us to picture as the prototypical carrier. As a young, responsible gun owner physician, I disagree with every point your guest is making. I don't carry from fear. Is it unfair to paint everyone with the same brush, Furman?
Of course it is. Of course it is. You know, that's why I was describing the gun guy demographic is preponderantly the group that favors gun ownership. If you look at the polls of demographics of who, where the large percentage of support for gun ownership comes, it is from that demographic. African Americans, for example, have typically been a population that is very much in favor of gun control.
All right, I want to talk about this. After the Sandy Hook shooting, the president talked about closing what's been called the gun show loophole that allows vendors mm-hmm. at those shows to sell without background checks. Mm-hmm. Studies found 80% of Americans supported that idea, but the legislation went nowhere.
Right. Well, according to The Hill, it was actually, which is a publication out of Congress in D.C., it was actually 92%. And that's very interesting. This is one of the things I'm trying to wrap my head around on this issue, is that I draw a parallel to Obamacare. If you ask individual people, no matter their party allegiance, how they feel about specific provisions of the bill, of the health care reform bill, they will tell you they approve it. They like this. I like that. I like that. Yes. And then if you turn around and ask the bigger question, how do you feel about Obamacare? They'll say, I hate it. And so I find that there's a similar phenomenon going on with gun rights. When it comes to specific provisions, sure, many or most people are in favor of it. But then when you turn around and say, how do you feel about gun rights as a whole, or how do you feel about gun control as a whole, that triggers something visceral in people, and they'll instinctively say yes or no, even when they may support certain gun control measures.
Lots of people look at tragedies like the movie theater shooting in Aurora in 2012 and wonder if innocent lives could have been saved if the facility that James Holmes attacked had allowed patrons to take in firearms. What's your perspective on this?
Well, he opened up with some tear gas canisters and it was a barrage of bullets in a darkened movie theater. I'm not sure how individual gun owners leaping to their feet would have made that situation better. They may have shot many victims as well before they got the assailant himself. Would they have diminished the death toll? I don't know. It's hard to say. What if another gun owner, what if there are two gun owners, with permits in the audience, and one leaps to his feet and starts firing, and another one mistakenly thinks that he is the attacker and shoots him down? That's why police are critical of inserting or getting rid of these gun-free zones. That's why they're critical of having these gun owners prosecuting justice on their own terms in these kinds of situations. It is a recipe for more disaster. Police themselves make enough mistakes as it is, when they are trying to carry out the law and fire their weapons, as we've seen.
Just a reminder, we did a show on the Bill of Rights Monday that also touched on the Second Amendment. You can find the podcast at kera.org/think. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Billy on the line in Dallas. Hi, Billy.
Yes.
Hi.
How are you? Good morning. What I was called about, I was trying to find out if what percentage of people own guns as far as black people and white people. And I'm sure probably it's going to fall on the other hand as where more white people own guns than black people do. I own guns. I belong to the National Rifle Association, but I belong to the National Rifle Association for a whole different reason. I got in the National Rifle Association because I think this tag that's right above my registration would save my life if a policeman stopped me in the rural area where I am lots of times. So I want them to see that I belong to the National Rifle Association, not because I agree with them, but because I think that'll have influence on the police department.
So are you black or white, Billy?
I'm a black person.
And you're afraid that
you're
afraid that police would find you with a gun, and if you didn't have an NRA sticker, you would be suspected of doing
shot
something
down.
Wrong.
Hmm. Right on the spot.
What do you want to say to all that, Furman?
Well, I do not know the rates of ownership, across the races specifically, but I have heard a lot of similar concern. There's plenty of anecdotal evidence out there that African-American individuals, open carry or concealed carry, are treated quite differently by law enforcement than are their white counterparts.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Clay in Dallas. Hello, Clay.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi.
I was just wondering if there were any studies or statistics specifically involving the results of, say, a gun owner using their firearm to either stop a crime or, in the midst of a crime to try to stop, are there any studies or statistics to see whether this is actually, a beneficial thing or a harmful thing?
What do you know, Furman?
Sure. Well, I mean, the gun rights movement is going to offer up copious amounts of evidence. There is one thinker, particularly named John Lott, who wrote a book called More Guns, Less Crime. And he offered up some evidence in that vein. And when he was pressed upon it, the statistic, offhand, you would think that's a very difficult thing to prove. How do you prove that at a gun in any given case diffuse a situation or deter a crime? That's hard to wrap your head around, and John Lott felt that he could, and then when pressed on the evidence, he could not produce it. And this kind of evidence that the gun rights movement puts forth to, testifying to the deterrent factor of open carry guns, this has been debunked over and over again.
You said earlier that there are cases where you fear that enforcement and defense of our Second Amendment rights is infringing on our First Amendment rights.
Yes.
How does gun ownership get in the way of something like free speech or free assembly?
Well, I wanted to say one other thing about the campus carry law in Texas, and that this will answer the question in part. While I've heard that most complaints of campus carry are practical concerns, and I think they are very real. By the way, I'm looking here. The second most common crime on college campuses involves drug and narcotic violations. So this is just a bad idea to have these firearms involved. where the number one crime is theft. As a college professor, I have tried to imagine what it's like having guns in the classroom, either on myself, on my body. And this was recommended after the shooting of Virginia Tech, by the way. Mm-hmm. Gun rights advocates turned around and they said the solution to shootings like Virginia Tech is more guns, not fewer guns. We need more out there. We need armed students. We need armed professors, armed staff. And I've tried to imagine what guns in the classroom will do to the dynamic of the classroom setting. Universities have a civic mission. They are incubators for our democracy. And when we have students in the classroom, you know, we are undertaking a very serious charge there, which is to prepare them for this democracy, to make them open and open-minded and interested and curious and interested in engaging others and learning how to negotiate differences with others. And the classroom is also this special place where controversial ideas are aired. And sometimes they are offensive. And sometimes people take offense. And we must learn, as citizens of a democratic society, to diffuse those peacefully. And guns in the classroom, I think, communicate the opposite. And they would urge professors to be reticent and their peers to be reticent. I have asked students the same question. Many different places that I've taught, they all agree. I don't see how it is going to enhance the civic mission of the university, that's for sure. It can only make it more difficult.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Daniel is on the line now in Flower Mound. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Chris. I heard your guest talk earlier about what it would be like to have a possible other shooter in a place like Aurora or Tucson. And I was just wondering if your guest had heard that in the Tucson, Arizona shooting in, I believe, 2011, there was actually a man who heard the gunshots from around the corner who was, I believe, a CHL holder who came around and almost shot the man who had actually wrestled the shooter to the ground.
Yes.
I think a lot of people forget that point and that this kind of went unheard of in the media. But someone with a gun almost shot the actual hero in the situation in Tucson, and I would like to see hear your guest's comments on that.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I mean, I mentioned in the book, and I've written about that in other articles. I mean, concealed carry permit holders are humans as well, and they are liable to mistake, just like anybody else. A gun does not make you inherently more virtuous and more objective and insightful. Just as the same way that a gun doesn't ruin character. A gun, you know, whenever there's a shooting, gun rights advocates like to say, don't blame the gun, blame the people behind the gun. The gun didn't do the killing. The gun doesn't make people bad. Well, I would say this conversely, a gun also does not make people good. They are mere instruments. Okay. And there is this tendency among the concealed carry population. They suggest that carrying a gun will make you inherently more responsible. And I think that is false.
Of course, concealed carry proponents have pointed out, you know, you take that same example and they say he almost shot an innocent person who was trying to help, but
sure.
He didn't. He, in fact, was able to sort of ascertain that that was not the right thing to do and did not fire his weapon.
Right. And what are we going to do, though, when there is even more guns in our public spheres, openly or concealed carry? And in that same Tucson shooting, 8 people pull out their guns at the same incident. Who's going to shoot whom then?
I want to talk about stand your ground laws. 23 states now have some form of them. What kinds of, if the word is privileges, do these laws afford people who happen to be carrying guns?
Well, if they sense the threat of harm to their person, they may fire and they may use deadly force. That's how the law is described in its letter, pretty much, in the Florida statute. And what that means is that that would seem to accommodate feelings of threat. If you feel threatened, and one of the incidents that you're justified, or you may be justified, according to the judge's discretion, you may be justified in firing your weapon. And one of the more egregious cases that I talk about in the book and I've written about elsewhere is the case in the movie theater in Tampa, Florida, where Curtis Reeves fired on a man. They had just had an argument, and the other man flung popcorn in his face, and he fired on him. His lawyer afterwards said, Reeves' lawyer afterwards said, Well, he was justified. Curtis Reeves was justified in firing in that instance because he did not know the nature of the weapon the other assailant had, or even if he had a weapon. But here's the point. In a stand-your-ground society, it makes good sense to think that your opponent has a gun and is similarly emboldened and is similarly threatened and similarly emboldened to fire upon you. So why not fire? So stand-your-ground, I argue, is a very bad idea because that is inviting these kinds of incidences, and it is eroding rule of law.
Interesting email here from Don, who writes, I don't appreciate the author's contention that about guns in mass shootings such as Aurora. I don't know whether I would be effective in stopping the shooter, but at least I wouldn't be helpless. I don't think it's up to him to deny me that possibility.
I understand the sentiment. I understand the sentiment completely, but I think the solution is not to arm more people in the theater. I think the solution is to work harder to reduce the number of guns out there and to work harder to make sure that people like Mr. Holmes do not have access to guns. That will make us safer. That will make us far safer. That's what every industrialized democracy in the world, that's what they have shown is the way. And there's really no reason we can't.
With 300 million guns in this country, Furman, is there any possibility that without some kind of, radical gutting of the Second Amendment, that we could ever get rid of all those weapons? I mean, should we assume that they are here to stay?
That is a tempting solution. I would say, first of all, that, there have been buybacks in other democracies. Australia implemented one and in a matter of 10 years reduced its arsenal by about a third. Of course, Australia is a much smaller country. That's a question. That's a very difficult one. I'm not sure what to make of that or what to say. I'm not generally optimistic about it. All I'm calling for is that, at the very least, we make it more difficult for certain people to get their hands on guns that should not, and that we counteract this emergence and intrusion of guns into the public sphere.
Furman de Brabander is my guest. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at Maryland Institute College of Art and author of the new book, Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to philosopher Furman de Brabander about his new book, Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here that says, what about the argument that increasing gun regulation is targeting the wrong gun owner? In 2013, there were 50,869 convictions that involved a gun in some way, armed robbery, assault, etc. Only 0.3% of those convicted were concealed handgun license owners.
Well, there's a lot of contention on that kind of data as well. There is an organization called the Violence Policy Center that points out that conviction rates for permit holders is much higher than the gun rights movement would like to admit. The gun rights movement, the radical portions of it, they do like to characterize concealed carry permit holders as extremely virtuous. And I'm sure they're good people, but again, good people make mistakes, and the conviction rates do seem to be much higher than the gun rights would let on, according to the Violence Policy Center.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Chris is on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
I'm just, this campus carry, I don't even see how the professors themselves are going to be able to teach their classes knowing that someone out there, 1 to 10 to 20 kids, are going to have a handgun on them. And I just don't think that's right, that the campus, a learning institution should have people with guns other than security officers or the campus police. But I have a daughter graduating next year from high school, and now we're trying to find colleges that don't allow campus carry because she's worried about it. So that's just, I just wanted to give that tidbit in. It's just an unfortunate thing here in Texas.
Thanks for your call. Anything you want to respond to there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's eroding the learning atmosphere, quite frankly. One of the philosophers that I talk about in the book is John Dewey. He's a political philosopher. He was based here in Baltimore for a while. And he is one of the premier philosophers of democracy in America and of education. He argued that the school and the college classroom, this is a critical place. This is a critical place where our democracy is nourished because the school offers socialization. People get to know people of different backgrounds, sometimes very different opinions, and they have to learn to negotiate them and get along. And guns, by contrast, they communicate. I've been looking at some pictures of the open carry advocates marching or standing in front of the state capitol in Austin with their assault weapons. They're intimidating. Guns communicate. Guns communicate a threat. And they sow mistrust and suspicion. And none of these are beneficial to free speech. In fact, they contradict it.
Is it possible that the things that guns communicate has been at least partially responsible for declining crime rates? Meaning, you know, if I've thought about maybe robbing a house or a store or mugging somebody on the street, I'm going to think twice about that knowing that in my state, that person might well be carrying a weapon that could kill me.
I doubt it. I really do. I live in Baltimore City, where something like 10% of the population is addicted to drugs. I don't believe any of those drug owners would care a whit if I'm carrying a gun if they need something. In many cases, the criminals are better armed than the lawful citizens themselves, and that's all thanks to the NRA efforts to ensure that the loophole remains and that the ATF is weak and that criminals can get access to guns. So I doubt that. And the other point I would make, Chris, is that the dramatic decline in crime rates we're seeing, the bulk of it happened in the 1990s before the great liberalization of our gun laws. The assault weapon ban only expired in 2004, but half of the reduction in crime rate happened before 1999.
Let's go
so
back.
I don't believe there's no correlation.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Well, I think you've said it all. The essence of what I see gun ownership, and especially showing your gun, is that you're the one to be afraid of. And it just reminds me of that great line in Breaking Bad, I'm the one who comes knocking. You know, there's no logical way to disseminate as many guns as there are in America and think that it is not just an out-of-control situation. And when a culture becomes as out-of-control in that, with something as dangerous as that, you really have a problem that is never going to be resolved except to make them illegal again.
Furman?
Well, I don't know about that last point, but what I would say about the other is regarding that caller who called earlier about Aurora, you know, and the idea of having that we should be able to have guns in the cinema to shoot him down. Gun rights advocates say, I need that as a last resort. Well, the gun rights world, sorry, I should say the NRA society that they would have us live in is one of last resorts. It is one where you must live by the gun and die by the gun. And, you know, that is not a society most or many Americans want to live in. I don't believe, and I argue this in my book, that most gun rights advocates actually appreciate what that means. That is a society where in gross civic disrepair. And Wayne LaPierre, he argues in his bombastic speeches over and over again that we are on the verge of catastrophe, falling into a state of nature. Well, guess what? Or I should say, you know, state of war of everyone against everyone. Well, guess what? Thanks to NRA efforts, they are making that world come true. They are creating the very world in which their own arguments ring true and pertain.
What about the argument that guns allow people who are not physically strong to defend themselves in case of assault? And I'm thinking particularly about people who say, you know, women who carry a gun have some hope of being protected if they are assaulted to be raped.
Well, I would say a couple things to that. The gun rights movement likes to argue that, you know, women should have access to guns because they can help in cases of domestic abuse. And yet the evidence from public health researchers points the obvious, the opposite, actually, that, you know, a gun in the home, you know, is involved with higher incidences of domestic abuse because it makes perfect sense. If there's a gun in the household, even if it is a woman's gun, and she is in a situation of domestic abuse, who's to say the abuser can't access the gun as well? That's one thing I would say. The other thing I would say is there is this argument in the gun rights movement that guns are needed to enforce a functional equality. Well, again, that's a very tenuous equality. If I require a gun to be equal, well, that means I better watch my back, because as soon as my gun is withdrawn, well, then I am at the mercy of other people. We need to enforce equality in a different way entirely.
What's happened to crime rates in Australia where it has become more challenging? It's not impossible to own a firearm, but it is more challenging than it once was.
It's fallen quite a bit. They have seen a reduction in their murder rate of about a half, actually.
50%?
That is, fire gun-related murders has fallen in half from 1990 to 2010.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Doug in Fort Worth. Hey, Doug.
Hey. Your guest quoted a gun rights advocate saying that more guns equals fewer crimes, and world statistics belie that. The United States has more per capita than anywhere else in the world, as I understand it, about 80 per 100 in the population. A distant second is Serbia, who has 60. So by that theory, the U.S. has the fewest crimes in the world. Serbia has the second fewest. And we have the highest percentage of incarcerated citizens anywhere in the world. That argument carries no traction. Why is that? Are the statistics faulty? There's a disagreement on cause and effect. How do you explain that?
I'm not sure I understand the question, sir. Can you please repeat it?
I think world statistics clearly prove that more guns does not equal fewer crime.
No, I agree.
And why does that argument not carry any weight with anybody?
That's the great mystery that I wish to understand. Right. I mean, the American Journal of Medicine, they recently revealed a study that, you know, high gun ownership makes countries less safe. Hopkins has a similar study here in Baltimore. Harvard has a School of Public Health. There are numerous studies out there. And that is the big question that I open my book with, which is why is our political scene resistant to the abundant data out there? And by the way, I would also like to point out that the NRA has repeatedly blocked funding of more and more detailed and more requested evidence of gun violence at, say, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta or the NIH. So there is abundant data out there that's not even conducted yet. Perhaps that's because the NRA knows how damning it is. But there's already plenty of, and Stanford has an important study that's also been released recently, saying that right to carry laws are linked to higher rates of aggravated assault. The studies are out there. I don't know why that is. I argue in my book, I think it's because of the political appeal of the NRA. They say that guns equal freedom. And people either seem to be open to that suggestion, or the bulk of the voting public, which is in favor of common sense gun safety laws, for whatever reason, does not deem the situation sufficiently alarming to take on the NRA in a manner that would be required, because the NRA is a very well organized, a very passionate organization. It would take a special effort to combat them.
Is the firearms industry particularly profitable?
I think it is. That's not something I did any research about, but I think it is. I mean, you know, the more I thought about this issue, I kept coming back to the militarized society that we live in. I'm speaking to you here from Maryland. The defense industry employs so many people here. We had the government shutdown a few years ago, and so many people were impacted, not only the public sector but the private sector, because of all the defense industry contractors who rely on federal dollars, Northern Virginia as well. It is, you know, our military outfit, the military industry is maybe, what, number one or two in terms of what remains as our manufacturing base. You know, we are militarized, and we're at constant war. I mean, our defense industry is doing very well, clearly.
So you don't want to yank the Second Amendment from the Bill of Rights. Most people who are in full support of broad and expansive gun ownership rights still would agree that it's important for those guns to be used by people who are responsibly planning to use them and who have some training. But that's about as close as the two sides come. Is there some place for middle ground where these two sides, both of which feel that they have the truth on their side, can have some kind of conversation that is ultimately fruitful and brings us a little closer to agreement?
Well, I mean, there's many paths out there. You know, there are many democracies that have gun laws on the book, but they regulate it and they make sure it is safe and that the guns do not fall, as far as possible, do not fall into the hands of those who will perpetrate crimes. And their success is borne out by much lower crime rates. So there is some practical middle ground available. And I would also point out that, you know, of the gun control advocates I've met, I have not met many who are in favor of getting rid of the Second Amendment altogether. They are painted as being extremists, but by and large, I've not found that to be the case.
You tell us in the beginning of the book that what you don't want to do is prescribe policy, but surely you've given this some thought. Are there kinds of laws that you think lawmakers should be considering that would allow us to serve the needs of people with really different interests with regards to guns?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think top of the list would be that we would need to close the private transaction loophole, which sometimes called the gun show loophole. That makes perfect sense to me. And the ATF needs to be bulked up. The ATF has been eviscerated by the NRA's efforts in Congress. It's almost a joke. You know, the gun rights advocates like to say, we don't need any more gun rights laws, new gun control laws. We need to prosecute better the ones that are on the books. Well, the problem is that the federal agency in charge of that has been eviscerated and is unable to do this. It must be bulked up, must get more funding, more agents, and more powers. Beyond that, you know, it's funny you point there about my policy suggestions. I think open carry, concealed carry, stand your ground, and campus carry are all very bad ideas. I think retracting them would be in order.
Furman de Brabander is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Maryland Institute College of Art. His new book is called Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. Furman, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.